Swimsuit? Check. Sunscreen? Check. Phone charger? Check. Don't forget to pack the 5-Hour Energy. It fits great in a pocket or carry-on, and the alert feeling will help you arrive ready for anything. Now get 20% off when you use code 5HETRAVEL at 5HourEnergy.com. Expires April 30th. One-time use only. Not valid with other discounts. Remember, visit 5HourEnergy.com and use code 5HETRAVEL to save 20%.
What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did-we-just-hit-a-million-orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
Welcome to another BritFlix.com podcast. My name's Stuart Wright, and today's guests are the co-directors of Scala, or The Incredibly Strange Rise and Fall of the World's Wildest Cinema and How It Influenced the Mixed-Up Generation of Weirdos and Misfits. Welcome, Jane Giles and Ali Catterall. We're going to do a bit of a discussion about the documentary, and then we're going to break off and talk about three films that have influenced everything in your adult life. So let us start with Scala, 3 exclamation marks, I should add. Following the book, where does the journey for the documentary begin?
Good question. So when the book came out, published by Fab Press in September 2018, several different people actually asked whether or not there was going to be a documentary based on the book. Because it was very cinematic in terms of, obviously, its subject matter. It's a book about cinema. But also, there were stories in the book that weren't really kind of like, that needed kind of like more space to come out. So I started looking into the idea of doing a documentary based on the book. And also, I'd stumbled across some bits of archive footage that I didn't know existed, some amateur archive, a whole hour-long chunk of it, which I didn't know about before. Sort of came out the woodwork after the book was published. Also a 3-minute-long student film shot at the Scala in 1992. So I knew there was archive footage that hadn't been seen before, in addition to the fantastic Michael Clifford 30-minute film Scala that he made for Cable London back in 1960. And also, sort of more importantly, I knew that I had some people around me who were interested in making a really good film about Scala. First and foremost was Channel X, who were the first producers on board. They mostly made television comedy. They made the Incredibly Strange Film Show with Jonathan Ross back in the day, and that actually launched at the Scala. They made the Vic and Bob Shooting Stars programs, and also they made Detectorists, the fantastic metal detector, I don't know what you call it, comedy drama. It's a sort of folk drama. It's wonderful. So they came on board, and along with Andy Stark, who is the producer of the films of Ben Wheatley, Peter Strickland, Prano Bailey Bond. So we started kind of like exploring what a film about the Scala would look like. We actually tried to find a director for it and couldn't find anyone available at that time. That was like back in sort of 2019. And so the producer said to me, "You do it." And I knew that I couldn't do it on my own. So I said, "I'll do it if my editor of my book, Ali Catterall, who I'd met during the researching of the book. He's someone who has a really interesting story to tell about being a student up the road. So the producer said, go for it. So that's how Ali and I ended up co-directing this documentary about Scala, which is sort of loosely based on the Scala book that we discussed back in 2016.
So Ali, and this the question I'll ask you and Jane as well, but first you, Ali, what was the first time you crossed the threshold to go to the Scala? What took you there in the first place?
Well, this is interesting because I didn't live anywhere near King's Cross. I lived down in Chelsea, near World's End.
Right.
We kind of what we call the wrong end of Chelsea. And the reason I was in King's Cross, which no one with any sense would have gone if they didn't live in King's Cross already, because it was an incredibly insalubrious place, as you possibly know. It was I was studying a very progressive liberal college of further education called Kingsway Princeton College, it was called then. It was a place where the Sex Pistols had actually attended, I wouldn't say educated, but attended about 12 years before me. People like sort of John Lydon and John Wardle, Jar Wobble, and John Beverly Ritchie, and all the Johns. They're all called John. Okay. And they all attended Kingsway. And as I said, it was a very sort of liberal place. And it was for kind of school dropouts or kind of sort of smart working class kids or otherwise distracted children. People like me who'd come from a extremely bad background and an incredibly, can I swear on this podcast?
You can, yeah, yeah.
Incredibly fucking fucked up background. I'll give you the top line later of that when we talk about performance. But for now, I found myself in Kingsway. And Kingsway was about 5 minutes walk from the Scala. And I was coming out of Kingsway one day in, I think, October, so about a month after I started, and I saw there was a film called Birdie there by Alan Parker. It was with Nick Cage and Matthew Modine. And it was a story about obsession and mental illness, and a guy thought it was a bird. Actually, he was a Vietnam vet. He had a traumatic, terrible time, and it sort of got into his head. And I thought, that's for me. That's absolutely up my street. And I went in, and I was incredibly daunted. Because at that age, you know, sort of 1986, you know, the only sort of places available to me were those kind of moth-eaten sort of multiplexes, you know, your kind of local multiplex where, this, you know, the aromas of popcorn and candy are kind of pumped in and you're seeing, you know, your usual kind of mainstream fare. So the Scala was something very, very different. And that was what happened. And gradually I fell in love with it. And it became a home from home.
And do you remember a tipping point where it becomes a home from home? Because obviously there's stumbling across a place and then there's making somewhere kind of like your cultural home, as it were.
Yeah, it took about a month or so. During that time, probably as is probably common with people who enter the Scala, you start inviting your mates, almost for kind of protection. In a way, it's like, you know, this place is fucking mad. You have to experience this. And so, you know, you start taking friends and sooner or later, you become a little gang and you start going and then you start taking sort of dates and you start taking other sorts of people and until finally it gets under your skin and into your bones and the Scala then becomes very much part of your DNA. And I think that's the experience for a great many people.
Jane, for you then, what was your first memory of that moment that you were drawn to going out for the first time?
My experience is slightly different from Ali's in that I lived outside of London near Gatwick Airport. I was 16 years old, so just 17 years old in the summer of 1981. And I was knocking around with a bunch of school friends, a bunch of punks who would go up to London and explore the King's Road, go to venues. Like, I remember, like, we had a trip up to the Lyceum to see the Cramps. So we go to gigs and they discovered the Scala in Fitzrovia, just off the Tottenham Court Road. And it just moved in 1981. Channel 4 came and sort of evicted the Scala from its premises in Fitzrovia in April 1981. Okay. So the cinema owner, Steve Woolley, and his staff managed to negotiate a bit of cash from the deal of Channel 4 coming in to find alternative premises, which was actually barely a mile up the Euston Road to King's Cross. So they moved in 3 months flat. It was an extraordinary feat. And so I was there in August 1981, after the Scala had opened in King's Cross in July 1981. I was there for an all-nighter. I came up with my mates from Crawley. They already knew, like I said, the Fitzrovia Scala. They were a bit scornful of this massive, dirty old picture palace in King's Cross. I think they liked the other one because it was sort of like fairly newly built, been built in 1976 as the other cinema. And it was quite intimate and it was underground, whereas the Scala in King's Cross was overground and up. But I just fell in love with it at first sight. So my experience was different from Ali's in that I went with a group of friends from the outset. I went to an all-nighter and I fell in love at first sight. Rather than, and it was sitting there in that massive auditorium watching films like The Living Dead at the Manchester Morgue, five films in a row, being with a group of people, being away from home, which was really important to me. I knew that I could stay up all night because I'd spent the summer cleaning airplanes at night as part of a crew in Gatwick Airport, just to earn some sort of holiday money. But I'd become part of that sort of nighttime economy and found it quite magical, actually. I mean, the sights of the lights, you know, kind of like across Gatwick at 3 o'clock in the morning were stunning, and sun rising and rabbits running down the runways. It was really sort of special. So I like that feeling. And the auditorium of the Scala at night, even though there are people sort of sleeping on the floor between the rows, between the films, but like sitting there pushed up against my boyfriend listening to Joy Division for the first time. I don't think I'd heard the band before. I remember sitting there hearing Love Will Tear Us Apart sort of booming around that massive auditorium, when cinemas, like Ali alluded to, how other types of cinemas were at the time. So I was literally used to the you know, the Embassy in Crawley that would show play Windmills of Your Mind as intermission music. I think it's sort of great now. I would listen to Windmills of Your Mind now, but at the time it just seemed really like old school and really sort of stifling. This was something really new.
What comes across clearly in the documentary is, as much as there was a fantastic program at the, you know, from the day it started, so to speak, it was always a bit on the edge. It was always daring. Often experimental stuff was shown. But going to see films is ordinarily a kind of almost like it's a shared experience, but it's also a singular experience. So how, because the shared experience is just sitting in quiet dark with loads of strangers. That's generally how a cinema works. But what's clear from the documentary is a social life emerged out of the Scala, which doesn't seem to sort of go with the idea of going to see films. So why do you think that is the case? I mean, Ali, you talked about, you know, one of your tipping points was you just started to bring your friends along and stuff, you know, this weird and wonderful place. So what is it about sort of that kind of film culture that sort of breeds itself, as it were?
I think you have to look at the fact that the Scala, more than many other reps at the time, had been and continue to be in places a music venue. And I think that's very important. I think it's significant to look at something that's more than a cinema, something that has the kind of community vibe, or at least kind of gang treehouse mentality of a gig. These were films as gigs. They were not films as kind of sacred objects that you kind of turned up to and venerated necessarily, although people certainly did. But think of it as a kind of gang mentality. And this is reflected in the kind of tribes who went there, and certainly tribes who were from, you know, from a kind of almost sort of social cultural kind of point of view, music tribes, quite a lot of them. So you had the rockabillies, you had the punks, you had the post-punks, you had the goths. You know, you had all kinds of people. So all those tribes came together to give you that kind of gang mentality, which was more like going to a gig, if you like. So when you're sitting there in the Scala in the dark watching the films, it's almost like you're watching a band. It's almost like you're watching bands on film, and obviously quite literally you are when you're watching music documentaries. But yeah, I guess Jane would probably have more to say about that as well too.
Well, that's right. And I think what's really interesting is that it was that immediate post-punk moment when it started, 1978. And the thing about punk, obviously, it had that DIY, like anyone can be on stage. And I think the Scala had that feeling that actually the people in the audience were often the same as the people who were making the films that were on the screen. In the case of Derek Jarman, for example, he was someone who would literally come to the Scala to watch movies, but also to watch the audience for his own films, like Jubilee and Sebastiani that were shown at the Scala. So I think it's got that. And also because the Scala audience was quite raucous, like a punk gig, or like any gig, actually, or nearly any gig, not everyone, but, you know, people would shout out, there was this sort of sense of audience participation that really sort of like went along with the vibe of the venue and the nature of the films that were shown. And people at that time would certainly sort of like identify themselves culturally by the places that they went and the films that they watched and the t-shirts that they wore and the badges on their lapels. And I think the Scala was really a place that accommodated this kind of, well, it, you know, it goes back to what Ali was saying. It was a sort of tribal gatherings, but I think critically is the post-punk thing, and also the political allegiances and the social allegiances that people made. So I remember back in 1980, a friend having her passport photograph done and being turned down for a visa for America because she was wearing a CND badge. So you'd wear your CND badges, you'd wear your anti-apartheid badges, you'd wear your punk badges on your lapel. And you would pick up your Scala program and you'd put it up on your wall, and your friends would come round and they'd see that you were a member of this place. You'd have your little membership card in your wallet. So I think there are all these sort of like cultural signifiers that enabled people to feel very much part of a scene when they went to the Scala.
I think one of the ideological tent pegs of punk as well was that sort of breaking down of the wall, the division between the audience and the people on the stage. And I think this was another kind of, you know, very much a kind of MO of the Scala and that kind of vibe, you know, that as Jane's alluded to, you know, sometimes the people in the audience would be the people whose films you were watching. And that definitely came out of punk. I mean, this was amongst all reps, probably with the exception of something like The Screen on the Green, which literally hosted the Sex Pistols and The Clash. This was the punk, London's punk cinema, you know, with that vibe and that legacy.
To tell a story over 15 years is a long period of time. So pulling that information together and everything you had at your fingertips and everything you'd known, plus new interviews you were able to gather, what do you remember being the biggest storytelling challenges for a documentary about Scala? Because to me, you cram a lot into it. So in what sense, I mean, obviously, let's not talk about what's on the cutting room floor, but think about what were the challenges for you guys as the filmmakers? And I guess, if I start with you, Ali, as kind of bringing it from a kind of audience point of view, what were you hopeful to get across in terms of the story for the Scala documentary?
You know, I always say this, but first of all, as a kind of nascent debutant co-director, I've realised the most important thing when you make your documentary is to honour your subject. Hence, the film has a certain kind of aesthetic and a certain vibe, and is using sort of mixing and matching particular kind of aesthetics from bygone retro films, the sort that would show at the Scala, hence sort of split screen and jump cuts and a slightly sort of grimy vibe. More than that, as you rightly say, the Scala story is incredibly epic. It's sprawling. I mean, for me, it's no exaggeration when I say I think it's genuinely the subculture equivalent of something like the V&A, the Victoria and Albert Museum. It's that big, you know, it's bigger than the Roundhouse or the Exploding Plastic Inevitable or whatever it is. You know, it's huge. So to do this, there's a series of kind of entry points that we could have gone. I remember very pretentiously in the early days, I mean, Jane may remember this about 2 or 3 years ago, wanting to call it an all-nighter at the Scala. And this is when we thought we'd have more money, actually. We were going to frame it as a series of kind of, we were going to frame the film like a conceit of kind of five films, you know, sex, drugs, rock and roll, with those kind of intertitle cards and we'd have a different kind of thing. And for me, it was going to be quite woozy, the ambience. It was going to be quite ambient and woozy and quite sort of dreamy and dreamlike until we decided, no, let's just make a slightly straighter documentary than that. Some of these things are a consideration, as I say, the budget. Some of them are, as I said, because we wanted to get the vibe of the Scala. That was really important to us. And what we've ended up with, I think, is very much like the Scala. It's this kind of kaleidoscopic, eclectic, incredibly Catholic scrapbook kind of approach that hopefully and truthfully and authentically sort of gets over the Scala experience.
And what about for you, Jane? Because obviously you were both the punter who went to see films and gig and bands there, but also you became the programmer there as well. So you had a very much an active role in what it did. So what for you were the storytelling challenges for you in this documentary?
So we decided fairly early on in the filmmaking process that what we wanted to do was focus on the audience's voices, the audience who went on to become filmmakers, writers, musicians, artists, actors, and activists. That was our structure. Mm-hmm. We knew that we wanted a sort of approximate three-act structure because that's that makes for a satisfying piece of storytelling. We knew that we wanted to make a big screen documentary because the subject matter and the form follows the subject matter. So and actually the sort of sprinkling in of the management voices in the film, Stephen Woolley, myself, Jane Pilling, Joanne Seller, Mark Fallon, Helen DeWitt were the cinema managers who were interviewed for the film. That actually came quite late into the process because we realised that in order to make something that worked historically in terms of its three-act structure, as well as emotionally, we needed certain bits of information about the beginning, the middle and the end. Mm. So we needed the management to talk about that. It wasn't necessarily something that the audience could say, although we did ask each of our interviewees, and we had 50 of them. We wanted a lot of voices in this because the Scala audience was 1 million people over 15 years. And so we wanted to get a lot of different types of voice into our film, both in terms of like gender and class and ethnicity. And I think we managed to achieve that. But we also managed to achieve like 50 hours worth of interview footage. So one of the biggest challenges in making the film was in whittling that interview footage, which was a lot of gold dust and as well as a lot of rubbish, down into one third of a 90-minute long film. So that's where the brilliance of our editor, Andy Sark, also our producer, assisted by a guy called Ed Mills. And we all worked together to kind of like shape the piece. And just to add that the three-act structure is roughly, we thought about sex, drugs and rock and roll, but not in that order. We've got rock and roll, sex and drugs, and there's a bit of kind of preamble and a bit of legacy. But it's sort of roughly around that, or as Ali puts it, it's the sort of lead up to the party and then the hangover and the sort of remorse at the end. That's more or less our structure. What we knew we didn't want to do was a fairly straightforward Sky Art style documentary, historical documentary, where the management, the sort of, you know, the white management tells the people who weren't there what it was like. What we wanted was our diverse audience expressing what it felt like to be there.
Yeah, no, and that's definitely the feel. That's definitely what you get as a viewer, a sense of, and I say that as someone that never got to go. I grew up in Manchester, so the Scala was very much advertised in the classifieds of the music press and things like that from where I was viewing it from. So it was like, and I was seeing the kind of films you were programming and thinking, I can't see that. That's a banned video or, you know, whatever it might have been. And so the Scala was always this sort of place on high ground from where I was looking, but I never got to see it. So to watch the documentary is so much fun to get the sense of, I got a sense of what I missed out on, not in a kind of regretful way, but the way people shared their experiences of it made me feel like, you know, yeah, that was a gang, that, I mean, not a specified one, but it was a gang.
We certainly made the film so that it would work for an audience who weren't there at the time. So obviously, if we only made it for the people that were there and are still alive, then that would be a very small group of people. And we found by taking the film out to festivals and internationally and cinemas around the country, that people really do have a point of connection with it. And it's interesting that some of the strongest voices coming out of the actual audience for watching our documentary are those of 20-something young women who come up to us and say, oh my God, you know, I want to set up a film club. I want to work in archives. I want to work in cinemas. You know, they're super keen on it. But also people who, and even though this gala did have an audience from all over the UK and even internationally, and we saw this from the mailing list of the monthly programme, but being close to King's Cross, the major terminus, really facilitated like ease of transport to London. But we've also found that people are, you know, it rings a bell with them about like maybe you had a place in Manchester that had a feeling like that. It might not have been, it might have been a record shop. It might have been a vintage clothes shop. It might have been something else. But it's certainly kind of touching the emotions of people just sort of thinking about what their version of the Scala was or could be.
I think James really touched on it. I mean, like in Liverpool, you have Eric's. In Manchester, you have the Hacienda. You know, these are music places. But as I said earlier, you know, the Scala as a cinema had more in common with kind of music venues than almost in the cinema.
Mm. Well, I mean, even like the what was, I mean, we've now got Home in Manchester, but there was the Corner House. And so I was able to see things like a John Woo triple bill and things like that. So the flavour of what I thought of as Scala, I could get access to bits of it. But I think for me, looking at it, certainly in the eight, through the 80s prism, was the Scala was like I could have seen the Forbidden Fruit as a boat, which is something that you know, it comes across really well. And not in a kind of like, weren't we daring way, but it just like, it was like, why not? You know, it was more of a why not show, because it was, in the end, they're only films. They're not as dangerous as the government at the time liked to make out that they were. We've come to the end of our conversation about the documentary. I'll put links and dates in the show notes so people can find out how to watch it in the new year. But now we shall move on to three films that have impacted everything in your adult life. Just so you know, what we're going to do is we're going to do your three films. We'll have a 5-minute timer going on, so that when 5 minutes are up, you will hear this noise at 5 minutes.
Okay.
And that's our 5 minutes up, and then we move on to the next film, okay?
Okay.
Right then, let's start off with your first choice, which is Un Chant d'Amour by Jean Genet, 1950, a 25-minute sort of long short. So what was the reason for choosing this film? Where does this fit in your film fandom and maybe in reference to the Scala?
Well, as I said, I discovered the Scala in August 1981, and then I carried on going to the Scala throughout the 1980s, and I started at film school in Reading in 1983, and was doing a very interesting course and discovered the films of Rainer Werner Fassbinder. And we were studying melodrama, and so like Fassbinder's melodramas, Fear Eats the Soul, compared to, you know, the films of Douglas Sirk. So it's quite an academic course, but really exciting. It really opened up ideas about wanting to seek out films by those filmmakers that we were only sort of learning about, not necessarily seeing their complete works. So the Scala provided a sort of alternative, like parallel curriculum to what I was studying at film school in Reading. And I noticed that the Scala was showing Carell by Fassbinder. And having really loved Fear Eats the Soul, I went to seek it out at the Scala from home, from where I was living in Reading. And there was a short film showing with it, and that was called Un Chant d'Amour. I didn't know that at the time because the film had no kind of like header on it, like the title was lost. It was silent and the projectionist was playing, I think, Eric Satie music or something like that, over the top of this silent black and white 25-minute long film, which was about two men in prison trying to communicate through the prison wall. And it was very romantic and very explicit. And I couldn't quite believe what I was seeing. It was sort of like, what is this? What is this little scrap of film? And I looked at the programme. I saw it's by Jean Genet, who wrote the book of Cruel of Brest that the Fassbender film was based on.
Ah.
And I became really interested in Jean Genet, and I started like reading his books and being really excited by that literature in the way that, you know, music and film and books and, you know, what your friends were reading and recommending all became part of the thing. You'd read William Burroughs because your friends recommended it, or Jacques Chirac, a very kind of like 80s publishing scene. So I couldn't find any information in the library about Enchant d'Amour. It's obviously pre-internet. This was mid-80s, pre-internet. And then when I finished my film course, I asked my teacher what he thought I should do next. And he suggested that I should do an MA in film. So I asked if I didn't want to, like, everyone at that time was doing like MAs or PhDs in the films of Alfred Hitchcock, or, you know, and it was massive and I didn't want to do that. So I said to him, and his name is Richard Kiernoski, actually was a fantastic, he was a great teacher, still is a great teacher at the London Film School. But he would go on from that point to direct a lovely film called Love and Death in Long Island with Jason Priestley and John Hurt in it. Anyway, Richard said, well, when I said I could only really imagine writing about something really small, he said, why don't you write about Enchant d'Amour? So I applied to film, applied to Kent University to do an MA to by research and thesis, and my subject was...
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
Looks like you need a vacation. Enter the 5-Hour Energy Where Will the Tide Take You sweepstakes. You could win a $10,000 dream beach vacation. Imagine jet setting off to a tropical paradise, having fun in the sun, or diving at a gorgeous reef. It's up to you. No purchase necessary. Go to 5hetide.com for official rules and to enter. That's 5hetide.com. Enter today. Ends June 30th, 2024.
Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Buy one, get one free on flavorful fresh Tyson chicken during our full line sale. Then mix or match during our 99 cent sale and get Kraft mac and cheese, Campbell's soup, or Bar S Franks for 99 cents each when you buy five or more, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Enchant d'Amour by Jean Genet, I thought it was a good idea to study and research something that there was very, very little information about. And right at this moment that I started work, Jean Genet died. And I read an obituary of him by an American author called Edmund White, who was famous for his semi-autobiographical novel, A Boy's Own Story.
Mm.
He was an American writer living in Paris. And I wrote to him and asked him where he got some of his information in the obituary from. And he, being Edmund, a very generous person, immediately invited me to go meet him in Paris and collaborate with him. He was writing this massive this massive biography of Jean Genet. It's like 800 pages or something. And I was write my thesis about this little film. So we worked together. He took me to the south of France to meet Lucien Senimo, who was one of the men in the film. And I got incredibly privileged information for my thesis. Actually, I didn't understand film studies. I didn't understand psychoanalysis and semiotics, but I did understand history. And my thesis was published as a book by the BFI in 1991. And it also that led to them obtaining the rights to Enchantement, publishing it on VHS and DVD, and film prints of it being available to this day.
Amazing.
New score from Simon Fisher-Turner, which is beautiful as well. And it was like a really, it's an important film for me because it's not only beautiful and great and really sexy with these gorgeous men and their naked bodies in it. It was just the sort of thing that a woman like me wanted to be watching. But also it was my first publishing gig.
Your second film is A Clockwork Orange, Kubrick's classic from 1971. Do you want to tell us where that fits in the Jane Giles canon?
Sure. So Enchantement is a really interesting example of a film where the rights kind of like came and went. Mm-hmm. And all films are subject to rights. And I grew up in an era where it was impossible to see Clockwork Orange in the UK because it had been withdrawn from distribution back in the early 70s. I think everyone knows the story. I won't go into it now.
Yeah.
It was due to kind of like, you know, threats of violence against the director, due to kind of, you know, sort of supposed copycat violence, or sort of youth, like violent youth saying Clockwork Orange made me do it type thing with defense. So it's really hard to see this film. And you'd have to go to Paris, which wasn't any hardship. You know, you could fly or go on the boat to Paris. You could see the film in cinemas there. You go to Berlin, you could see it there. But when I was managing the Scala in the late 80s, early 90s, we had a selection box in the foyer for people to put their suggestions of films that they would love to see in it. And every single day you'd get like slip after slip after slip after paper scribbled in biro, Clockwork Orange, please, 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 Clockwork Orange, Clockwork Orange. People were really desperate to see this film, not on pirate video. I wasn't really a kind of like video watcher. I'd grown up with Betamax in the house, so we could rent those big videos like Evil Dead, like pre-Brightbill, pre-Video Nasty. But when by the time I was a student, like video machines were too expensive and computers didn't exist. So cinema was really the only way, or television was the only way of seeing films. So at the Scala, when I had the opportunity to show a collector's print on 35mm of A Clockwork Orange on my big screen, and I had that, you know, sort of authority to show what I wanted, I made a very hasty decision to put the film on in a double bill with as a surprise film, double bill with Lindsay Anderson's film If.
Mm-hmm.
And it turned into a sort of nightmare. The screening was an illegal screening. It was reported to the film's distributor, Warner Brothers, who reported it to the trade organization, the Film Distributors Association, who reported it to the Federation Against Copyright Theft, which was an organization set up, funded by the studios to fight illegal VHS replication.
Yeah.
They pursued a criminal prosecution against me as the person, as the, you know, responsible person of the organization at the time who'd made the decision to program the film.
Yeah.
The whole case dragged on for a year from 92 to 93 and was a really depressing, drawn out, expensive procedure. It's not the reason why the Scala closed. Scala closed because the lease ran out and the parent company, Palace Pictures, did not exist by that point. They'd gotten into financial problems. Also, King's Cross was being redeveloped to make way for the Channel Tunnel terminus that eventually came into St. Pancras. So there was all, and it was a time of recession, as well as kind of like the growth in VHS. So audience behavior was changing. So that's a rather long-winded way of saying that the film impacted on me because I did make a decision to show. I did take responsibility, but it's kind of followed me around for the last 30 years.
Yeah.
People say, you know, you closed the Scala by showing Clockwork Orange. I didn't close the Scala by showing a Clockwork Orange. It didn't help, but it wasn't the reason.
What year was that when you showed it at the Scala?
1992. I'd actually just left my job. I'd sort of moved on. I was working in film distribution by that point, but continued to be the person, you know, liable,
even though I was not actually
working at the Scala by that point.
Yeah, because
I left in mid-92.
Just to give the listener a sort of context, you not only sort of showing it, breaking the copyright problems, but the ban wasn't lifted till 99 on seeing the film full stop. So
yeah, I mean, I think this is one thing that was interesting. Like at the time, the kind of press coverage of the court case, Screen International, now Screen.com, Screen Daily, published a really nice little piece.
Finish your thought.
Saying, I hope that when A Clockwork Orange is finally re-released by Warner Brothers after Kubrick's death, they'll give a full apology and financial reparation to Jane Giles. And that's exactly what happened in terms of the reissue 6 months or a year or so after Kubrick died. And no, I never got an apology or financial reparation. But the film finally came out and now audiences can see it legally in all its glory.
And then finally, Ridley Scott's 1982 sci-fi noir Blade Runner.
So Blade Runner, when I talked about like that summer that I was cleaning airplanes in Gatwick Airport, the lights at night and the feeling of the sun rising and the rabbits, everything, it had a real, that was the summer that Blade Runner came out in the UK. And it had a real vibe to it. And I loved Blade Runner at first viewing and did program it at the Scala. But then I was talking with Clockwork Orange about becoming a distributor. And that was the reason why I left the Scala. But Clockwork Orange became unavailable to cinemas to book. Blade Runner became unavailable to cinemas to book when it was under license for the Blade Runner 2046, the prequel or the sequel,
or
you know, whatever it is. So the rights have been withdrawn. The Scott, the Blade Runner partnership that owned the rights to Blade Runner withdrew the film from distribution. By that point, sort of 2008, 2010, I was running distribution at the BFI. We were doing a big sci-fi Christmas season, and the film that I really wanted to re-release as a classic, modern classic, was Blade Runner, which at the time was withdrawn from distribution. It took me probably a year to negotiate the rights with Blade Runner partnership, with multiple lawyers involved. It was a really, really tricky negotiation, which I finally achieved. I had an enormous sense of personal achievement in managing to legally license this great movie that wasn't available to cinema audiences at the time. And the film went on to be like one of the BFI's most financially successful reissues of all time. So it was hugely profitable. Just wonderful. And just to finish up that thought, I took my daughter, I went with my husband and our kids to see Blade Runner at NFT1 as part of the South Bank season when it was reissued by the BFI. And there were people in the audience like Spiz Energy, you know, it's like it was a full cinema. People had really turned out for it. It was a great vibe. We'd had to license the director's cut. That was one of the conditions, even though I wanted to license the version that originally came out on first release with the voiceover. I always really loved the voiceover. Mm-hmm. And I was sitting there watching it in the NFT, and my daughter turned to me at that point towards the end when Harrison Ford is dangling from the building and Rutger Hauer, who's dying, uses his last shred of energy to pull Harrison Ford up on top of the building. And my daughter turned to me and said, "Why did he do that?" And I whispered in her ear, "Perhaps at that moment he loved life more than you know, and kind of whispered the voiceover that was originally put in, brought out the confusion of the audience at that point. It was a magical moment. And I think that all three of those films that I've chosen as being films that have kind of followed me throughout my life and my career are chosen because they've been sort of magic, but also they've been representative of moments in my career where I've been able to make something more widely available, because that's really the role of the film distributor, which has been my primary job throughout the last 30 years.
I think it's interesting when you pick up that point about the sort of excitement within the audience, you know, that which is the thing. I think that's the thing about what you would call event cinema, which is like, obviously, week to week, we get new releases. So there's kind of like, if I miss this bus, I'll get the next bus that comes along. Whereas when you're programming a retrospective or a kind of classics thing, or even just things that don't fit in with the release program, there's a sense of an event. I mean, I was at the Variety screening that you did the Q&A at. And at that event, I could sense that there was an excitement, you know. And I think there's something about that in cinema. You kind of know when you're at one, don't you? Everyone's coming in and people are seeing faces they recognise, and that all adds to the buzz.
We're so excited that the BFI South Bank are doing a whole season of Scala films, great Scala greatest hits. And we're planning, and there's also some events, and we're planning some special intros, which are going to be thematically themed intros, people being costumed. There'll be like audience participation, which I'm sure is a nightmare for some people. But we really want to make a point about the liveliness of the audience.
Brilliant. Well, look, thank you for sharing those three films.
Thank you, Stuart. Really, always a pleasure speaking with you. And I'll hop off now.
Thank you. Thanks for joining me. Take care. Have a good week. And I will abruptly now move on to, I'll let Ali into the room.
Hi, how are you doing?
First off is a performance directed by Donald Cammell and Nicholas Roeg from 1970. Where does that fit in with Ali Catterall? Your note you gave me was Where I Come From.
Yes. So do we all know what performance is about? Shall I give the top line of performance for those who are not aware of what performance is? So performance, it stars James Fox and Mick Jagger, and it's directed by Donald Cammell and Nicholas Roeg, and it's kind of where the Krays meet Aleister Crowley. Via The Order of Assassins. Very strange 60s reference points. They all kind of come together in this glorious, often pretentious, and completely fucked up melange. And it's about a gangster, played by James Fox, who's on the run, and he holds up in a fading rock star's house in Notting Hill, played by Mick Jagger. And James Fox's kind of gangsterism, Mick Jagger sees a way to kind of re-embrace his demon that he's lost, his kind of stage persona, his kind of demon. And he thinks he can get this from James Fox, whereas James Fox just wants an escape at all costs. And unfortunately, he bites off more than he can chew. So by the end of the film, both of them have kind of merged into each other's personality through kind of...
So what makes this film important to you?
This film is where I come from. I grew up, I didn't grow up in Notting Hill. I grew up in Chelsea, which is kind of southwest of Notting Hill. But
yeah,
I grew up in a bohemian squat in what I would say is Angela's Ashes poverty, or perhaps being hippie, it was lentil poverty, below the breadline, with a Crowleyite stepfather, a practicing warlock for a stepfather and a radical feminist for a mother. Who later became General Secretary of the Fawcett Society. He was a psychopath. He was a regular practitioner of black magic under my startled nose. And all this is happening in this lentil poverty council squat. We were what you'd call kind of poor with books. There were hundreds of paperbacks, yellowing paperbacks around, surrounded by hippie paraphernalia. Or rather more kindly, we were arts and crafts. I think you might get the vibe here. When I watch performance, there's certain scenes in that, particularly where James Fox first encounters Power Square, where Mick Jagger lives, in which he sees kind of feral sort of children running amok, through Power Square. That whole vibe was my childhood, basically. To watch performance now is to revisit an extraordinary time for me. I'll also mention the fact that where I grew up might as well have been an enormous soundstage. I grew up in a road called Lotts Road, which is a kind of slum elbow of just off the King's Road in Chelsea, directly opposite the Lotts Road power station. And we were a kind of big bohos. We were a kind of archipelago of otherness. You know, we were surrounded by fellow bohos. We lived above an American performance poet who kind of held open house for kind of fellow artists and political dissidents and up and coming musicians, one of whom was called Philip Glass, who used to visit.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, next door with a modern classical composer and an underground filmmaker from Oz, who'd sort of project film noir classics and exploitation movies on his backyard late into the evenings. One of my first memories of kind of sprawled on exotic cushions by hippies kind of watching these films. It was almost virtually a primer for the Scala, and incredibly cinematic. And for me, it kind of seemed natural that kind of film crews and commercial makers and video and music videos directors would kind of haunt our streets for years looking for sort of atmospheres. You can actually see my road in an old Ready Break advert. It was the hip hop one where everyone's sort of glowing like beacons. And sort of, you know, if you go and Google Ready Break hip hop, you'll find it immediately. That's Lotts Road. And as someone comments in the comments, you know, that looks like the aftermath of a nuclear war, man. And, you know, it just looked like that. That was how horrible it was. That's where I grew up.
Yeah, I was going to say, yeah, because for the, oh, there goes the 5 minute bell. I'll just say one more thing. London's come a long way in 50 years, hasn't it? Kind of thing.
I live around the corner now. We moved to a rotting house with no roof. I mean, I remember once my bedroom ceiling fell in when I was 17, and pigeons would kind of fly around the room, sort of Alfred Hitchcock style, and I was reduced to sort of sleeping on the floor on a dirty mattress, surrounded by Tupperware containers, having a kind of TikTok rain orchestra sort of around me. So that was my life by the time I discovered the Scala. So it's interesting to me that the kind of content of the movies I saw there was just as surreal and disturbing, sort of outlandish as anything from my home life. But somehow the fiction of these films provided a kind of safety net, a kind of filter, this kind of crucial remove from reality, you know, which is why the Scala became a kind of refuge for me, as it did for so many other people. So to cut all this down, performance is where I come from. That's my life.
So in terms of London being like a theatre set, being like a film set, then Theatre of Blood from 1973, your second choice, is almost like a technical heightened version of London in the early 70s, isn't it?
Theatre of Blood is also, I mean, it's one of the great London films, funnily enough. But, you know,
it is. No, without a doubt.
In which you got the cast and crew sort of roaming the depressed capital of the early 1970s. And in fact, the area I grew up in as well, again, I liken it to a kind of enormous soundstage, because there is almost every slab of that bit of Chelsea has had a film crew pass it. I mean, point of fact, there's a scene in Theatre of Blood where a guy's drowned in a vat of wine, and that the entrance to that little place is literally around the corner from Uncle Monty's place and With Nell and I, or, you know, or where it was shot. Across the road is where Alex DeLarge gets a kicking from some old blokes underneath the Albert Bridge. The houseboats just beside it are where Oliver Reed works in, I'll never forget what's his name. And then, of course, around the corner, there's Dracula's, you know, mini-skirted acolytes from Dracula AD 1972. I mean, it's
no way.
Yeah, almost every, I'll have to take you down there one day, almost every slab of that square mile, the blow-up house, the party house and blow-up is there. So I grew up, as I said, on an enormous soundstage, which must have helped. I mean, it impressed upon me the fact that kind of reality and fantasy were very close to one another, and they could be sort of punctured like skin, if you like. I mean, added to this, the fact that a friend of mine, a family friend called Paul Oliver, who's in everything, you'll see him in everything. Once you see him in one thing, you'll see him in everything, is in Theatre of Blood. He's being prodded awake by Michael Horden at the beginning. You see Paul Oliver in Star Wars when C-3PO and Luke walk into the cantina, and he's sitting on the right, you know, at a table by himself. You'll see him in American Werewolf in London, in a sex cinema, sort of gazing with horror as David starts changing. You'll see him in everything. So yeah, Theatre of Blood, my all-time favourite film. I think sort of, yeah, and personal for those reasons, not least of which the fact that I too am a member of the critic circle. So thoroughly expect to be done in by a maniac in a week anytime now, you know.
I mean, does it, out of interest, because obviously framing something for a film means that what's not in the frame we can't see. But obviously when you're looking at a place that you're familiar with, are you able to sort of remove the reality when you're seeing the places, or do you see the place that it really is?
I see the place. I mean, particularly where I grew up, Lots Road. I mean, like, you watch the opening of Quadrophenia, the scene immediately after he's standing on the cliff edge. You've got Phil Daniels and co and Phil Davis kind of racing down the road. That's Lots Road. That's my road. The place where I'm living now is actually in a Terence Trent D'Arby video in Sign Your Name. You can literally see my head in that. Yeah. It's. I mean, that was... And you can see the Lots Road power station in there as well. Also, very personal film, Theatre of Blood. I realise we haven't exactly said what it's about. It's about a critically...
It doesn't matter. Also, people can find that out.
Also, Theatre of Blood, very personal for me as well, because it started me on the road to becoming a film critic, because it was the very first film review I ever wrote, age 14, for English, right? In my
really?
Yeah, there you go. That's that review, Theatre of Blood. There you go.
And aged 40, because it's quite, I mean, what surprised me with Theatre of Blood, because I only saw it when they did the Blu-ray reissue. I'd never seen it before then. And I was surprised at how, I mean, it's funny, but it's a violent movie.
It's I just love it. I've written here, age 14, the witticisms fly fast and furiously amid many stomach-churning scenes. And I end the review going, a superb cast supported by beautiful gags, although not recommended for young children. I mean, I was 14, for fuck's sake, you know what I mean? But yeah, it's I love it. I love it so much.
I mean, it's like an anthology. So for the benefit of the audience, what's your favourite sequence of the revenge that's meted out?
Oh, God, it's got to be Robert Morley and his poodles, I think. I mean, Robert Morley's poor poodles are baked in a pie after Cymbeline. It's basically Vincent Price's favourite of his own movies as well.
That doesn't surprise me.
He once said it was the best feeling of achievement and satisfaction I ever had from a film. And Katharine Hepburn once said that she thought that Price would have made a great Prospero from The Tempest. And I think really, you know, here's the evidence, really. Here's the proof. And, you know, the irony is, for me, although Lionheart's supposed to be this terrible actor, you know, one of the critics calls a ham sandwich, his Shakespearean soliloquies are actually really fantastically delivered in this film, I think.
And do you think it stands the test of time, Theatre of Blood? Oh, let's not worry about that question. There goes the timer. Moving swiftly along, but staying in the same year, 1973, is The Wicker Man.
The Wicker Man.
The single most important film of your life and career, you say to me in your teaser.
By the end of this speech, I'm going to make Dave about The Wicker Man. I'm going to convince you that magic actually exists, right?
Okay. I'm all for that. I'm here.
Right. I first saw The Wicker Man when I was 14 on the 25th of January, 1985. And I was watching it on LWT. It wasn't the 102-minute version. This was the theatrical cut for now.
Mm-hmm.
And unbelievably, on the other side, on Channel 4 that night, they were showing a Razorhead. So two Scarlet favourites immediately. And during the ad breaks, I would flick back over, while watching Razorhead, I'd flick back over to Wicker Man. I'd never seen either of them before. And my mind was completely blown. And after a bit, I ended up settling with The Wicker Man. I ended up sticking with The Wicker Man because it had a more sort of coherent storyline and also Britt Eklund, let's face it. So there you go. So I first saw it when I was 14. And I originally got into film writing. This is how I originally got into film writing. After I wrote an article for The Guardian about The Wicker Man for The Guardian in 1998. And that article led directly to a publishing deal. I was called up by Fourth Estate literally that the day the paper came out, which never happens, kids, by the way, who called up and said, would you like to write a whole book about The Wicker Man? And I was like, yeah, absolutely. And a week later, he called back. His name was Andy Miller. You may know him as he's gone on to become the host of a quite celebrated sort of literary podcast. But back then he was commissioning editor. And a week later he phoned back and said, "Oh, I'm really sorry, someone else is writing a book about the Wicker Man." So we had another week, myself and my co-writer, the late Simon Wells, crying into our sandwiches, going, "Oh God, we could have done it." You know, I was 29, you know, I wasn't even 30. And then he called back and said, "Would you like to write an entire book about British cult movies?" And for the benefit of your listeners, here it is. It's called Your Face Here, British Cult Movies Since the 60s. And it's the first book ever written about British cult movies exclusively. And it was quite sort of critically acclaimed at the time, if I say so myself. Anyway, and because of that book, during that book, that book had a chapter on Clockwork Orange in it. And because I knew that Jane's experience with the Clockwork Orange and the Skylark, I called her up and I said, "Jane," I didn't know from Adam at that point. I said, "Jane," this is back in 2000, "would you like to talk about the Clockwork Orange trial?" And she said, "No, fuck off." Quite reasonably, because it was still quite raw. You know, it was only like sort of, you know, 7 years or something after the court case. So I said, "Oh,
absolutely.
All right then." So because of this book, I became a freelance film writer for the next 20 years. And, you know, I got to know Jane again. Through things like that, and Jane then became then Jane invited me to co-direct Scala with her. Now I'll tell you this: the last billed film that the Scala showed before its closure in 1993, in a double bill with Witchfinder General, was The Wicker Man. And to honour this, we've made it a clip over the credits reel of the final film in our credits. And I want to tell you that on the summer solstice of this year, generally associated with May Day and with the film The Wicker Man, the BFI announced it had picked up UK and Ireland rights for our debut movie. Magic is real. I rest my case.
You thought it and you manifested it you manifest it and then it happens. Is that what you're saying?
And that is why The Wicker Man is the most important film of my life and career. Full stop. It's an extraordinary piece of work. I don't know what there is left to say about it, but it is, yeah, it's incredible. And now we're in the 50th anniversary of it, and I'm so delighted that more and more people will come to find
my my favorite little fact about The Wicker Man is how it was received in the Southern States of America not as a horror film but as a film about martyrdom, in the sense of Edward Woodward doesn't lose his faith, and that was seen as the power of God. And you're like, that is one brilliant reading of that film.
That's absolutely right. The producer, Peter Snell, and director, Robin Hardy, actually, as you say, took it round those states and said, "Do you find this offensive?" And they said, "No, because it's absolutely logical and correct within that framework." Mm. You know,
yeah. Absolutely phenomenal. Yeah. Well, look, sir, that's bang on 5 minutes.
Fantastic.
I will put, as I said in the interview part of the podcast, I will put links in the show notes about dates and stuff, and when I tweet about it, I'll say all that. It just gives me to say thank you very much for joining us on the BritFlix podcast.
Thank you. That's such great questions. Thanks so
Looks like you need a vacation. Enter the 5-Hour Energy Where Will the Tide Take You sweepstakes. You could win a $10,000 dream beach vacation. Imagine jet setting off to a tropical paradise, having fun in the sun, or diving at a gorgeous reef. It's up to you. No purchase necessary. Go to 5hetide.com for official rules and to enter. That's 5hetide.com. Enter today. Ends June 30th, 2024.
Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Buy one, get one free on flavorful fresh Tyson chicken during our full line sale. Then mix or match during our 99-cent sale and get Kraft mac and cheese, Campbell's soup, or Bar-S Franks for 99 cents each when you buy five or more, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.